By August 28th, he was pretty much in business, assisted by Laurie Constable and Dick Ellis. Dick had asked leave to quit the world of medicine and had been refused. "You're doing a fine job here," Richardson said. "You've learned a lot, and you're going to learn more. Besides, there's just too much for me to do by myself. As it is, we're going to be out of our minds if we don't get another doctor in a month or two. So congratulations, Dick. You're the zone's first paramedic. Give him a kiss, Laurie." Around 11 o'clock on that late August morning, Fran let herself into the waiting room and looked around curiously and a little nervously. "Hi, Fran," Laurie said. "I thought we'd see you sooner or later." The door to one of the examining rooms opened, and Candy Jones came out, followed by Richardson. Candy was looking doubtfully at a pink bottle in her hand. "Are you sure that's what it is?" she asked Richardson doubtfully. "I never got it before." "Well, you have it now," George said with a grin. "Don't forget the starch baths and stay out of the tall grass after this." She smiled ruefully. "Jack's got it, too. Should he come in?" "No, but you can make the starch baths a family affair." Candy nodded dolefully and then spotted Fran. "Hi, Franny. How's the girl?" "Okay. How's by you?" "Terrible." Candy held up the bottle so Fran could read the word Caladryl on the label. "Poison ivy. And you couldn't guess where I got it." She brightened. "But I bet you can guess where Jack's got it." They watched her go with some amusement. Then George said, "Miss Goldsmith, isn't it? Free Zone Committee. A pleasure." She held out her hand to be shaken. "Just Fran, please, or Franny." "Okay, Franny, what's the problem?" "I'm pregnant," Fran said, "and pretty damn scared." And then, with no warning at all, she was in tears. George put an arm around her shoulders. "Laurie, I'll want you in about 5 minutes." "All right, doctor." He led her into the examining room. "Now, why the tears? Is it Mrs. Wentworth's twins?" Franny nodded miserably. "It was a difficult delivery, Fran. The mother was a heavy smoker. The babies were lightweights, even for twins. They came in the late evening, very suddenly. I had no opportunity to make a post-mortem. Regina Wentworth is being cared for by some of the women who were in our party. She's been under sedation. I believe, I hope, that she's going to come out of this, but for now all I can say is that those babies had two strikes against them from the start. The cause of death could have been anything."
"Including the superflu."
"Yes, including that."
"So we just wait and see."
"Hell no. I'm going to give you a complete prenatal right now. I'm going to monitor you and any other woman that gets pregnant every step of the way. General Electric used to have a slogan, 'Progress is our most important product.' In the zone, babies are our most important product, and they're going to be treated accordingly."
"But we really don't know."
"No, we don't. But be of good cheer, Fran."
"Yes. All right, I'll try."
There was a brief rap at the door, and Laurie came in. She handed George a form on a clipboard, and George began to ask Fran questions about her medical history. "Fine," George said half an hour later. Fran raised her eyebrows, thinking for a moment he had mispronounced her name. For no good reason, she remembered that until the third grade, little Mikey Post from down the street had called her Fan. "The baby. It's fine." Fran found a Kleenex and held it tightly.
"I felt it move, but that was several days ago. Nothing since then. I was afraid..."
"Oh, it's alive, all right. But I really doubt if you felt it move, you know. More likely a little intestinal gas."
"It was the baby," Fran said quietly.
"It's going to move a lot in the future. I've got you pegged for early to mid-January. How does that sound?"
"Fine."
"Are you eating right?"
"Yes, I'm trying very hard."
"No nausea now?"
"A little at first, but it's passed."
"Lovely. Getting plenty of exercise?" For a nightmare instant, she saw herself digging her father's grave. She blinked the vision away. That had been another life.
"Yes, plenty."
"Have you gained any weight?"
"About 5 pounds."
"That's all right.
You can have another 12. I'm feeling generous today.
She grinned. You're the doctor.
Yes, and I used to be an OB man, so you're in the right place. Take your doctor's advice and you'll go far. Now, concerning bicycles, motorbikes, and mopeds. All of them a no-no after November 15th, let's say. No one's going to be riding them by then anyway. Too damn cold. Don't smoke or drink to excess, do you?
No.
If you want a nightcap once in a while, I think that's perfectly okay. I'm going to put you on a vitamin supplement. You can pick it up at any drugstore in town.
Franny burst into laughter, and George smiled uncertainly.
Did I say something funny?
No, it just came out funny under the circumstances.
Oh, yes, I see. Well, at least there won't be any more complaining about high drug prices, will there? And one last thing, Fran. Have you ever been fitted with an intrauterine device, an IUD?
No, why? Fran asked. And then she happened to think of her dream, the dark man with his coat hanger. She shuddered.
No, she said again. Good. That's it. He stood up.
I won't tell you not to worry.
No, she agreed. The laughter was gone from her eyes.
Don't do that.
But I will ask you to keep it to a minimum. Excess anxiety in the mother can lead to a glandular imbalance, and that's not good for the baby. I don't like to prescribe tranquilizers for pregnant women, but if you think...
No, that won't be necessary, Fran said.
But going out into the hot midday sunshine, she knew that the entire second half of her pregnancy was going to be haunted by thoughts of Mrs. Wentworth's vanished twins.
2 evenings later, Nadine Cross stood in the basement of Harold's house, watching him and feeling uneasy. When Harold was doing something that didn't involve having some sort of strange sex with her, he seemed to go away to his own private place where she had no control over him. When he was in that place, he seemed cold. More than that, he seemed contemptuous of her and even of himself. The only thing that didn't change was his hate of Stuart Redman and the others on the committee. There was a dead-air hockey game in the basement, and Harold was working on its pinholed surface. There was an open book beside him. On the facing page was a diagram. He would look at the diagram for a while, then look at the apparatus he was working on, and then he would do something to it. Spread out neatly by his right hand were the tools from his Triumph motorcycle kit. Little snips of wire littered the air hockey table.
You know, he said absently, you ought to take a walk.
Why?
She felt a trifle hurt. Harold's face was tense and unsmiling. Nadine could understand why Harold smiled as much as he did, because when he stopped, he looked insane. She suspected that he was insane, or very nearly.
Because I don't know how old this dynamite is, Harold said.
What do you mean?
Old dynamite sweats, he said, and looked up at her. She saw that his entire face was running with sweat, as if to prove his point.
It perspires, to be perfectly couth, and what it perspires is pure nitroglycerin, one of the world's great unstable substances. So if it's old, there's a very good chance that this little science fair project is going to blow us sky high.
Well, you don't have to sound so snotty about it, Nadine said.
Nadine, dear girl.
What?
Harold looked at her calmly and without smiling.
Shut your fucking trap.
She did, but she didn't take a walk, although she wanted to. Surely if this was Flagg's will, and the planchette had told her that Harold was Flagg's way of taking care of the committee, the dynamite wouldn't be old. And even if it was old, it wouldn't explode until it was supposed to.
Would it?
Just how much control over events did Flagg have?
Enough, she told herself. He has enough.
But she wasn't sure, and she was increasingly uneasy. She had been back to her house, and Joe was gone. She had gone to see Lucy and had borne the cold reception long enough to learn that since she had moved in with Harold, Joe, Lucy of course called him Leo, had slipped back some. Lucy obviously blamed her for that, too. But if an avalanche came rumbling down from Flagstaff Mountain or an earthquake ripped Pearl Street apart, Lucy would probably blame her for those things, too. Not that there wouldn't be enough to blame on her and Harold very soon. Still, she had been bitterly disappointed not to have seen Joe, to kiss him goodbye. She and Harold were not going to be in the Boulder Free Zone much longer. Never mind. Best you let him go completely now that you're embarked on this obscenity. You'd only be doing him harm, and possibly harm to yourself as well, because Joe sees things, knows things. Let him stop being Joe. Let me stop being Nadine, Mom. Let him go back to being Leo. But the paradox in that was inexorable. She could not believe that any of these zone people had more than a year's life left in them, and that included the boy. It was not his will that they should live. So tell the truth. It isn't just Harold who is his instrument. It's you, too. You, who once defined the single unforgivable sin in the post-plague world as murder, as the taking of a single human life. Suddenly she found herself wishing that the dynamite was old, that it would blow up and put an end to both of them, a merciful end. And then she found herself thinking about what would happen afterward, after they had gotten over the mountains, and she felt the old slippery warmth kindle in her belly. "There," Harold said gently. He had lowered his apparatus into a hush puppy's shoebox and set it aside. "It's done."
"Yes."
"Will it work? Would you like to try it and find out?" His words were bitterly sarcastic, but she didn't mind. His eyes were working over her in that greedy, crawling little boy's way that she had come to recognize. He had come back from that distant place, the place from which he had written what was in the ledger that she had read and then replaced carelessly under the loose hearthstone where it had originally been. Now she could handle him. Now his talk was just talk. "Would you like to watch me play with myself first, like last night?"
"Yeah," he said. "Okay, good."
She went up first, and she could feel him looking up the short skirt of the little sailor dress she was wearing. She was bare beneath it. The door closed, and the thing that Harold had made sat in the open shoebox in the gloom. There was a battery-powered realistic walkie-talkie handset from Radio Shack. Its back was off. Wired to it were 8 sticks of dynamite. The book was still open. It was from the Boulder Public Library, and the title was 65 National Science Fair Prize Winners. The diagram showed a doorbell wired up to a walkie-talkie similar to the one in the shoebox. The caption beneath said, "Third prize, 1977 National Science Fair, constructed by Brian Ball, Rutland, Vermont. Say the word and ring the bell up to 12 miles away." Some hours later that evening, Harold came back downstairs, put the cover on the shoebox, and carried it carefully upstairs. He put it on the top shelf of a kitchen cupboard. Rolf Brentner had told him that afternoon that the Free Zone Committee was inviting Chad Norris to speak at their next meeting. "When was that going to be?" Harold had inquired casually.
"September 2nd, Rolf had said.
"September 2nd. Chapter 47. Larry and Leo were sitting on the curb in front of the house. Larry was drinking a warm Ham's beer, Leo a warm Orange Spot. From out back came the steady, gruff roar of the lawn boy. Lucy was cutting the grass. It was the last day of August. Larry had offered to do it, but Lucy shook her head. "Find out what's wrong with Leo if you can." The day after Nadine had moved in with Harold, Leo hadn't appeared for breakfast. Larry had found the boy in his room, dressed only in his underpants, his thumb in his mouth. He was uncommunicative and hostile. Larry had been more frightened than Lucy, because she didn't know how Leo had been when Larry had first encountered him. His name had been Joe then, and he had been brandishing a killer's knife. The best part of a week had passed since then, and Leo was a little better. But he hadn't come back all the way, and he wouldn't talk about what had happened. "That woman had something to do with it," Lucy had said, screwing the cap onto the lawnmower's tank.
"Nadine? What makes you think that?"
"Well, I wasn't going to mention it, but she came by here the other day while you and Leo were trying the fishing down at Cold Creek. She wanted to see the boy. I was just as glad the two of you were gone."
"Lucy..."
She gave him a quick kiss, and he had slipped his hand under her halter and given her a friendly squeeze. "I judged you wrong before," she said. "I guess I'll always be sorry for that. And I'm never going to like Nadine Cross. There's something wrong with her.
Larry didn't answer, but he thought Lucy's judgment was probably a true one. That night up by King Super's, she had been like a crazy woman.
And have you noticed how white her hair is getting?
Larry nodded. He had. Now, half an hour after that discussion, he drank his hams and watched Leo bounce the ping-pong ball he had found the day the two of them had walked up to Harold's, where Nadine now lived. The small white ball was smudged, but still not dented. Thock, 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 against the pavement.
Bouncy, bouncy ball, Lee, look at the way we play.
You want to go fishing, kiddo? Larry offered suddenly.
No fish, Leo said.
Do you know Mr. Ellis?
Sure.
He says we can drink the water when the fish come back. Drink it without...
He made a hooting noise and waved his fingers in front of his eyes. His seawater green eyes were fixed on Larry's.
Without boiling it?
Yes.
Thock, thock, thock.
I like Dick, him and Laurie. Always give me something to eat. He's afraid they won't be able to, but I think they will.
Will what?
Be able to make a baby. Dick thinks he may be too old, but I guess he's not.
Larry started to ask how Leo and Dick had gotten on that subject, and then didn't. The answer, of course, was that they hadn't. Dick wouldn't talk to a small boy about something so personal as making a baby. Leo had just known.
Thock, thock, thock.
Yes, Leo knew things, or intuited them. He hadn't wanted to go in Harold's house and had said something about Nadine. He couldn't remember exactly what. But Larry had recalled that discussion and had felt very uneasy when he heard that Nadine had moved in with Harold. It had been as if the boy was in a trance. As if...
Thock, thock, thock.
Larry watched the ping-pong ball bounce up and down, and suddenly he looked into Leo's face. The boy's eyes were dark and far away. The sound of the lawnmower was a far-off, soporific drone. The daylight was smooth and warm. And Leo was in a trance again, as if he had read Larry's thought and simply responded to it. Very casually, Larry said,
"Yes, I think they can make a baby. Dick can't be any more than 55 at the outside. Cary Grant made one when he was almost 70, I believe."
"Who's Cary Grant?" Leo asked. The ball went up and down, up and down. Larry thought, "Notorious, North by Northwest."
"Don't you know?"
he asked Leo.
"He was that actor," Leo said. "He was in Notorious and Northwest."
"North by Northwest," Larry thought.
"North by Northwest, I mean," Leo said in a tone of agreement.
His eyes never left the ping-pong ball's bouncing course, and Larry was reminded eerily of Tom Cullen and his elephant.
"That's right," he said.
"How's Nadine, Mom, Leo?"
"She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her."
"Oh."
"It's bad now. It's bad with both of them.
Nadine and..." "Harold," he thought.
"Yes, him."
"They're not happy."
"He's got them fooled. They think he wants them."
"He?"
"Him."
The word hung on the still summer air.
Thock, thock, thock. "They're going to go west," Leo said.
"Jesus," Larry muttered. He suddenly felt the old fear sweep him. Did he really want to hear any more of this? It was like watching a tomb door swing slowly open in a silent graveyard, seeing a hand emerge. "Whatever it is, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to know it."
"Nadine, Mom, wants to think it's your fault," Leo said. "She wants to think you drove her to Harold. But she waited on purpose. She waited until you loved Lucy, Mom, too much. She waited until she was sure. It's like he's rubbing away the part of her brain that knows right from wrong. Little by little, he's rubbing that part away. And when it's gone, she'll be as crazy as everyone else in the West. Crazier, maybe."
"Leo," Larry whispered, and Leo answered immediately.
"She calls me Joe. I'm Joe to her."
"Shall I call you Joe?" Larry asked doubtfully.
No.
There was a note of pleading in the boy's voice.
No, please don't.
You miss your Nadine mom, don't you, Leo?
She's dead, Leo said with chilling simplicity.
Is that why you wouldn't talk after she came here? Did you know she was here that day we tried the fishing?
Yes.
It seemed to answer both questions. But you're talking now.
I have you and Lucy, Mom, to talk to.
Yes, of course.
But not for always, the boy said fiercely. Not for always unless you talk to Franny. Talk to Franny. Talk to Franny.
About Nadine?
No.
About what? About you? Leo's voice rose, became even more shrill.
It's all written down. You know. Franny knows. Talk to Franny.
The committee...
Not the committee. The committee won't help you. It won't help anyone. The committee is the old way. He laughs at your committee because it's the old way, and the old ways are his ways. You know, Franny knows. If you talk together, you can...
Leo brought the ball down hard. Thuck! And it rose higher than his head and came down and rolled away. Larry watched it, his mouth dry, his heart thudding nastily in his chest.
I dropped my ball, Leo said, and ran to go get it.
Larry sat watching him.
Franny, he thought.
The two of them sat on the edge of the bandshell stage, their feet dangling. It was an hour before dark, and a few people were walking through the park, some of them holding hands. The children's hour is also the lover's hour, Fran thought disjointedly. Larry had just finished telling her everything Leo had said in his trance, and her mind was whirling with it.
So, what do you think? Larry asked.
I don't know what to think, she said softly, except I don't like any of the things that have been happening. Visionary dreams, an old woman who's the voice of God for a while and then walks off into the wilderness, now a little boy who seems to be a telepath. It's like life in a fairy tale. Sometimes I think the superflu left us alive but drove us all mad.
He said I should talk to you, so I am.
Written down, Fran said.
He was right, that kid. That's the whole root of the problem, I think. If I hadn't been so stupid, so conceited as to write it all down... Oh, God damn me!
Larry stared at her, amazed.
What are you talking about?
So she told him, beginning with the day in June that Harold had driven into the driveway of her Ogunquit home in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac. As she talked, the last bright daylight changed to a bluish shade. The lovers in the park began to drift away. A thin rind of moon rose. In the high-rise condominium on the far side of Canyon Boulevard, a few Coleman gas lamps had come on. She told him about the sign on the barn roof and how she had been sleeping when Harold risked his life to put her name on the bottom. About meeting Stu and Fabian. About Harold's shrill get-away-from-my-bone reaction to Stu. She told him about her diary and about the thumbprint in it. By the time she finished, it was past 9 o'clock and the crickets were singing. A silence fell between them, and Fran waited apprehensively for Larry to break it. But he seemed lost in thought. At last he said, "How sure are you about that fingerprint? In your own mind, are you positive it was Harold's?" "I knew it was Harold's print the first time I saw it."
"That barn he put the sign on," Larry said. "You remember the night I met you, I said I'd been up in it, and that Harold had carved his initials on a beam in the loft?"
"Yes."
"It wasn't just his initials. It was yours, too. In a heart. The kind of thing a lovesick little boy would do on his school desk." She put her hands over her eyes and wiped them.
"What a mess," she said huskily.
"You're not responsible for Harold Lauder's actions, Keed." He took her hand in both of his and held it tightly. He looked at her. "Take it from me, the original dipstick, oil slick, and drippy dick. You can't hold it against yourself, because if you do..." His grip tightened to a degree where it became painful, but his voice remained soft. "If you do, you really will go mad. It's hard enough for a person to keep their own socks pulled up, let alone someone else's." He took his hand away, and they were quiet for a time. "You think Harold bears Stu a killing grudge?" he said at last. "You really think it's that deep?"
"Yes," she said. "Maybe the whole committee.
But I don't know what...
His hand fell on her shoulder, stilling her. In the darkness, his posture had changed. His eyes had widened. His lips moved soundlessly.
Larry, what...
When he went downstairs, Larry muttered. He went down to get a corkscrew or something.
What?
He turned toward her slowly, as if his head was on a rusty hinge.
You know, he said, there just might be a way to resolve all this. I don't guarantee it because I didn't look in the book, but... Oh, it makes such beautiful sense. Harold reads your diary and not only gets an earful, but an idea. All the best writers kept journals, didn't they?
Are you saying Harold's got a diary?
When he went down to the basement the day I brought the wine, I was looking around his living room. He said he was going to put in some chrome and leather, and I was trying to figure out how it would look. And I noticed this loose stone on the hearth.
Yes! She bellowed so loudly that he jumped. The day I snuck in and Nadine Cross came, I sat on the hearth. I remember that loose stone.
She looked at Larry again.
There it is again. As if something had us by the nose was leading us to it.
Coincidence, he said, but he sounded uneasy.
Is it?
We were both in Harold's house. We both noticed the loose stone, and we're both here now.
Is it coincidence?
I don't know.
What was under that stone?
A ledger, he said slowly. I didn't look in it. At the time, I thought it could just as easily have belonged to the previous owner of the house as to Harold. But if it did, wouldn't Harold have found it? We both noticed the loose stone. So let's say he finds it. Even if the guy who lived there before the flu had filled it up with little secrets, the amount he cheated on his taxes, his sex fantasies about his daughter, I don't know what all, those secrets wouldn't have been Harold's secrets. Do you see that?
Yes, but don't interrupt while Inspector Underwood is elucidating, you slip of a girl.
So if the secrets weren't Harold's secrets, why would he have put the ledger back under the stone?
Harold's journal.
Do you think it's still there?
Maybe. I think we better look and see.
Now?
Tomorrow. He'll be out with the burial committee, and the dean has been up at the power station afternoons.
All right, she said. Do you think I should tell Stu about this?
Why don't we wait? There's no sense stirring things up unless it's something. The book might be gone. It might be nothing but a list of things to do. It might be full of perfectly innocent things. Or it might be in code.
I hadn't thought of that.
What will we do if there is something?
Then I guess we'll have to bring it up before the Free Zone Committee.
Another reason to get it done quickly. We're meeting on September 2nd. The committee will handle it.
Will it?
Yes, I think so,
Larry said, but he was also thinking of what Leo had said about the committee.
She slipped off the edge of the bandshell and onto the ground.
Thanks for being here, Larry.
Where should we meet?
The little park across from Harold's. What about there at 1 o'clock tomorrow afternoon?
Fine, Larry said. I'll see you then.
Franny went home feeling lighter at heart than she had for weeks. As Larry said, the alternatives were now fairly clear. The ledger might prove all of their fears groundless. If it was otherwise, let the committee decide. As Larry had reminded her, they were meeting on the evening of the 2nd at Nick's and Ralph's place, out near the end of Baseline Road.
The 1st of September dawned gray and rainy, a dull, forgettable day, but one that no resident of the Free Zone ever forgot. That was the day the power came back on in North Boulder, briefly at least. At 10 to noon in the control room of the power station, Brad Kitchener looked at Stu, Nick, Ralph, and Jack Jackson, who were all standing behind him. Brad smiled nervously and said, "Hail Mary, full of grace." He yanked two big switches down hard. In the huge and cavernous hall below them, two trial generators began to whine. The five men walked over to the wall-to-wall polarized glass window and looked below to where almost 100 men and women stood, all of them wearing protective goggles as per Brad's order. "If we did something wrong, I'd rather blow 2 than 52," Brad had told them earlier. The generators began to whine more loudly.
Nick elbowed Stu and pointed to the office ceiling. Stu looked up and began to grin. Behind the translucent panels, the fluorescence had begun to glow weakly. The generators cycled up and up, reaching a high, steady hum, and leveled off. Down below, the crowd of assembled workers broke into spontaneous applause, some of them wincing as they did so. Their hands were raw and flayed from wrapping copper wire hour after drudging hour. The fluorescents were shining brightly and normally now. For Nick, the feeling was the exact opposite of the dread he had known when the lights went out in Shoyo, not one of entombment now, but of resurrection. The two generators supplied power to one small section of North Boulder in the North Street area. There were people in the area who hadn't known about the test that morning, and many of these people fled as if all the devils of hell were after them. TV sets went on in blares of snow. In a house on Spruce Street, a blender whirred into life, trying to blend a cheese and egg mixture that had congealed long since. The blender's motor soon overloaded and blew out. A power saw whined into life in a deserted garage, puffing sawdust out of its guts. Stove burners began to glow. Marvin Gaye began to sing from the loudspeakers of an oldies record shop called the Wax Museum. The words, backed by a steady disco beat, sounded like a dream of the past come to life. Let's dance, let's shout, get funky what it's all about. Let's dance, let's shout. A power transformer blew on Maple Street, and a gaudy spiral of purple sparks drifted down, lit on the wet grass, and went out. At the power station, one of the generators began to whine at a higher, more desperate note. It began to smoke. People backed away, poised just below the point of panic. The place began to fill with the sickish, sweet smell of ozone. A buzzer went off stridently. "Too high!" Brad roared. "Bastards crossing over! Overloading!" He scrambled across the room and slammed both switches back up. The whine of the generators began to die, but not before there was a loud pop and screams, deadened by the safety glass, from below. "Holy crow," Ralph said. "One of them's on fire." Above them, the fluorescence faded to sullen cores of white light, then went out completely. Brad jerked open the control room door and came out on the landing. His words echoed flatly in the big open space. "Get the phone to that. Hustle." Several foam extinguishers were turned on the generator, and the fire was doused. The smell of ozone still hung on the air. The others crowded out on the landing beside Brad. Stu laid a hand on his shoulder. "I'm sorry it turned out the way it did, man," he said. Brad turned toward him, grinning. "Sorry for what?" "Well, it caught a fire, didn't it?" Jack asked. "It surely did. And somewhere around North Street, there's a transformer all blown to shit. We forgot, goddammit, we forgot. They got sick, they died, but they didn't go around turning off their electrical appliances before they did it. There are TVs on, and ovens, and electric blankets all over Boulder. Hell of a power drain. These generators, they're built to cross over when the load's heavy in one place and light in another. That one tried there to cross over, but all the others were shut down, see?"
"If you say so," Ralph said doubtfully.
"Take my word for it," Brad said. "We've got the job to do all over again, but only on that one motor. We'll be in business. But..." Brad had begun to snap his fingers in an unconscious gesture of excitement. "We don't dare turn the juice on till we're sure. Can we get another work crew, a dozen guys or so?"
"Sure, I guess so," Stu said. "What for?"
"A turning off crew. Just a bunch of guys to go around Boulder and turn off everything that was left on. We don't dare turn the juice back on until that gets done. We've got no fire department, man."
Brad laughed a little crazily.
"We're having a free zone committee meeting tomorrow night," Stu said. "You come on over and explain why you want them, and you'll get your men. But are you sure that overload won't happen again?" "Pretty damn sure, yeah. It wouldn't have happened today if there hadn't been so much stuff left on. Speaking of that, somebody ought to go over to North Boulder and see if it's burning down." Nobody was sure if Brad was joking or not. As it turned out, there were several small fires, mostly from hot appliances. None of them spread in the drizzle that was falling. And what people in the zone remembered later about the 1st of September 1980 was that it was the day the power came back on, if only for 30 seconds or so. An hour later, Fran met Larry at Eben G. Fine Park across from Harold's. "See, you rode a bike too," Larry said. She nodded.
"Quieter."
"I stowed mine out of sight in that shelter. He nodded to an open-walled, low-roofed building by the playground. Franny trundled her bike between the swings and the slide and into the shelter. The odor inside was musty and fetid. The place had been a make-out spot for kids too young to drive, she guessed. It was littered with beer bottles and cigarette ads. There was a crumpled pair of panties in the far corner and the remains of a small fire in the near one. She parked her bike next to Larry's and came back outside quickly. In those shadows, with the scent of that long-dead sex musk in her nose, it was too easy to imagine the dark man standing just behind her, his twisted coat hanger in hand. "Regular Holiday Inn, isn't it?" Larry said dryly. "Not my idea of pleasant accommodations," Fran said with a little shiver. "No matter what comes of this, Larry, I want to tell Stu everything tonight." Larry nodded. "Yeah, not just because he's on the committee. He's also the marshal." Fran looked at him, troubled. Really, for the first time, she understood that this expedition might end with Harold in jail. They were going to sneak into his house without a warrant or anything and poke around. "Oh, bad," she said. "Not too good, is it?" he agreed. "You want to call it off?" She thought for a long time and then shook her head. "Good. I think we ought to know one way or the other." "Are you sure they're both gone?" "Yes. I saw Harold driving one of the burial committee trucks early this morning. And all the people who were on the power committee were invited over for the tryout." "You sure she went?" "It'd look damn funny if she didn't, wouldn't it?" Fran thought that over and then nodded. "I guess it would. By the way, Stu said they hope to have most of the town electrified again by the 6th. "That's going to be a mighty day," Larry said, and thought how nice it would be to sit down in Shannon's or the Broken Drum with a big Fender guitar and an even bigger amp and play something, anything, as long as it was simple and had a heavy beat, at full volume. Gloria, maybe, or Walkin' the Dog. Just about anything, in fact, except Baby, Can You Dig Your Man? "Come on," Fran said. "Let's go." Steady, hard rapping at first the front and then the back door convinced them that Harold's house was indeed empty. "How did you get in?" Larry asked. "The cellar window." They went around to the side of the house, and Larry pulled and tugged fruitlessly at the window while Fran kept watch. "Maybe you did," he said, "but it's locked now." "No, it's just sticking. Let me try." But she had no better luck. Sometime between her first clandestine trip out here and now, Harold had locked up tight. "What do we do now?" she asked. "Let's break it." "Larry, he'll see it." "Let him. If he doesn't have anything to hide, he'll think it was just kids or something. If he does have something to hide, it'll worry him plenty, and he deserves to be worried, right?" She looked doubtful, but didn't stop him as he took off his shirt, wrapped it around his fist and forearm, and crunched the basement window. Glass tinkled inward, and he felt around for the catch. "Here it is." He released it, and the window slid back. Larry slipped through and turned to help her. "Be careful, kiddo. No miscarriages in Harold Lauder's basement, please." He caught her under the arms and eased her down. They stood around the rumpus room together. The croquet set stood sentinel. The air hockey table was littered with little snips of colored electrical wire. "What's this?" she said, picking up a piece of it. "This wasn't here before." He shrugged. "Maybe Harold's building the better mousetrap." There was a box under the table, and he fished it out. The cover said, "Deluxe Realistic Walkie-Talkie Set." Larry opened the box, but the heft of it had already told him it was empty. "Building walkie-talkies instead of mousetraps," Fran said. "No, this wasn't a kit. You buy this kind ready to go. Maybe he was modifying them somehow." "Sounds like Harold. Remember how Stu bitched about the walkie-talkie reception when he and Harold and Ralph were out hunting for Mother Abigail?" She nodded, but there was still something about those snips of wire that bothered her. They went up the stairs, but this time the door at the top was locked. She looked at him, and Larry shrugged. "We've come this far, right?" Fran nodded. Larry bumped his shoulder against the door a few times to get the feel of the bolt on the other side, and then rammed it hard. There was a snapping metal sound, a clunk, and the door swung open. Larry bent and picked up a bolt assembly from the linoleum kitchen floor. "I can put this back on, and he'll never know the difference. That is, if there's a screwdriver handy." "Why bother? He's going to see the broken window." "That's true. But if the bolt's back on the door, he'll..." "What are you smiling about?" put the bolt back on by all means. But how are you going to draw it from the cellar side of the door?
He thought about it and said, "Geez, I hate a smart-ass woman worse than anything."
He tossed the bolt onto the Formica kitchen counter. "Let's go look under that hearthstone."
They went into the shadowy living room, and Fran felt anxiety start to creep up. Last time, Nadine hadn't had a key. This time, if she came back, she would have. And if she did come back, they would be caught red-handed. It would be a bitter joke if Stu's first job as marshal turned out to be arresting his own woman for breaking and entering.
"That's it, isn't it?" Larry asked, pointing.
"Yes, be as quick as you can."
"There's a good chance he's moved it anyway."
And Harold had. It was Nadine who had replaced it under the loose hearthstone. When Larry pulled the loose hearthstones aside, it lay there, the word ledger gleaming mellowly up at them in gold-filled letters. They both stared at it. The room seemed suddenly hotter, stuffier, darker.
"Well," Larry said, "are we going to admire it or read it?"
"You," Fran said, "I don't even want to touch it."
Larry picked it out of the hole and automatically wiped the white stone dust from the cover. He began to flip through it at random. The writing had been done with a felt-tipped marker of the sort that had been marketed under the pugnacious brand name Hardhead. It had allowed Harold to write in a tiny, perfect script, the handwriting of an intensely conscientious man, perhaps a driven man. There were no paragraph breaks. There was only an eyelash of a margin to the right and left, but that margin was constant, so straight that it might have been drawn with a ruler.
"It'd take me 3 days to read all this," Larry said.
"Hold it," Fran said, and reached over his arm to turn back a couple of pages. Here the steady flow of words was broken by a boldly boxed-off area. What had been enclosed seemed to be some sort of motto. "To follow one's star is to concede the power of some greater force, some providence. Yet is it still not possible that the act of following itself is the taproot of even greater power? Your God, your devil, owns the keys to the lighthouse. I have grappled with that so long and hard in these last 2 months, but to each of us he has given the responsibility of navigation. Harold Emery Lauder."
"Sorry," Larry said, "it's by me, you get it?"
Fran shook her head slowly.
"I guess it's Harold's way of saying following can be as honorable as leading. But as a motto, I don't think it's going to put waste not, want not out of business."
Larry continued to flip toward the front of the book, coming upon another 4 or 5 of the boxed maxims, all of them attributed to Harold in capital letters.
"Whew," Larry said. "Look at this one, Franny.
It is said the 2 great human sins are pride and hate. Are they? I like to think of them as the 2 great virtues. To give away pride and hate is to say you will change for the good of the world. To vent them is more noble. That is to say, the world must change for the good of you. I am on a great adventure. Harold Emery Lauder."
"That's the work of a profoundly disturbed mind," Fran said.
She felt cold.
"It's the kind of thinking that got us into this mess to start with," Larry agreed.
He flipped rapidly to the start of the book.
"Time's wasting. Let's see what we can make of this."